mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1998, novelist Walter Kern was living in Montana between novels and working as an editor for Time when he was asked to accompany a crippled dog to New York City to be adopted. It was then that Kern first spoke to a not particularly pleasant but intriguing man who said his name was Clark Rockefeller. Yes, that Rockefeller. Or so Kern thought. It was only after being arrested for kidnapping nearly 10 years later that Clark Rockefeller was exposed as Christian Karl Gerhard Schrider, not only an imposter, but now a convicted murderer. Kern's new book, Blood Will Out, is his account of being taken in by the eccentric and seductive sham. The book is part memoir, part true crime, and part expose of how class and status can be products of our own perception. And Walter Kern, we welcome you to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, tell us about that first conversation that drew you to New York to meet this man named Clark. What was your impression of him?
Well, he sounded like he had had a very insulated upbringing among, you know, prep schools and nannies and that kind of thing. I asked him what he did for a living, and his answer was, "I'm a freelance central banker." He said he ran the economies of third world countries from his home computer using special software and equations. And he also told me he'd never, for example, drunk a Coca-Cola or eaten in a restaurant. And he went on like this. And you might think it was preposterous, but to me, a novelist, it was first of all intriguing. And secondly, I'd met these privileged types. I went to Princeton and I'd studied at Oxford. And in my experience, they were all a little kooky. And he was no kookier than some of them. He was also pretty amusing to talk to, like no one I'd ever met. And so I made it a goal to meet him.
You're a really smart, really successful guy. Your novels, Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, have been made into films, the latter Oscar-nominated film starring George Clooney. You know, you've by this time, you've known him for 15 years. You were friends with him pretty much for 10 years. You're a journalist, and you never looked up his identity?
Well, I mean, his name was Clark Rockefeller, he said, and in about 2004, when it became more common to Google people, I put it into the computer, and I got many Rockefellers that were associated with the name Clark. There was a Mary Clark Rockefeller, who I believe was married to Nelson. John D. Rockefeller's first company was called Clark and Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
But in a strange way, I didn't expect that I would find him because he'd told me he was a very private person who kind of kept his identity off the internet. So when I saw this smoke but didn't ever see any fire in terms of direct references to him, I thought, well, he must be pretty powerful to keep himself off of these search engines. Mm-hmm. So in a weird way, it confirmed for me his position and power.
But we get this portrait of yourself and other people gratifying yourself or themselves by following the crumbs left out by Gerhard Schrider. I'm looking for an example that you can give to us of how you were taken in, or maybe some of the gaps you might have noticed then and figured out now that you know who he is. Oh, okay, that all makes sense to me.
Well, the first time I met him in New York, he took me over to his apartment to show me his art collection. And there were huge canvases on the walls and standing against the walls, Pollocks, Rothkos, de Koonings, Motherwells. And at some point he said, "Do you know how Mark Rothko died?" And I said, "I think he killed himself." And he said, "Right. Yes, he slashed his wrists in his studio." And he turned around one of these Rothkos that was leaning against the wall, and he said, "Do you see these little specks back here? This is actually the last painting he was working on when he died, and this is his blood." And all of that created this sort of huge, you know, and strange narrative that I was still processing by the time he moved on to another, you know, incredible story. He had the power to capture your mind and sort of stop your rational processes. And, you know, as a storyteller myself, at some level, I really enjoyed it. And I think I may even have sort of admired his mastery, though I didn't think of these necessarily as stories. I thought of them as true anecdotes, which were maybe being embellished.
Hmm. You were taken in.
Everybody fell for it.
Well, tell me
more.
There's
no evidence of anybody not falling for it who knew him. You know, I went to his trial when he was found out, and person after person got up there and said, I always suspected there was something about him, you know, that wasn't right. But they'd married him. They'd hired him. They'd gone to social events with him. If people were sitting around thinking he was a fraud, nobody ever acted on the suspicion.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did marry a woman who worked for McKinsey, I believe, Sandra Boss.
Yes.
She let him manage her family's money, and she made a lot of money. Now, he did have a house in Cornish. She did have a New York apartment, which I can imagine he could use as a backdrop for being Clark Rockefeller. But how did he get to that point? Can you help complete the ruse for us?
Well, he was very smart. One thing he knew how to manipulate was the system of private clubs on the East Coast. He went to a yacht club in Greenwich, Connecticut, and you know, he talked his way into it, and he held himself out to be important. And once that club admitted him, he had reciprocity at other clubs, and he'd sort of move on up the chain. And what he knew was that you can use props and other people to create credentials for yourself that then allow you to move into a yet higher circle. He was always positioning himself and using props like the paintings and associations with his colleagues. And you know, I'm sure he used his wife's position at McKinsey to make to get into parties that, you know, high level business people and so on. Mm-hmm. And you know, our job as human beings is not to be constantly running checks on each other. You know, in the last few years, we've seen this capacity to Google each other sort of expand out of control. But that was just not how it was done before. You asked if someone knew so-and-so, or you took it on faith when they were introduced by a friend of yours. To think that somebody is a complete fraud and that all their possessions are counterfeit and, you know, that their past is made up and that they, in fact, as he was, and aren't even an American, is a big leap and not something that the mind runs to immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially if you are, if you feel like you're getting this kind of sliver, this door opening into how the very, very wealthy and powerful live. I can imagine that being quite a seduction.
It was part of it in my case, but it wasn't just that I wanted to be with him. I wanted to hear the stories that he had to tell about that class of people. And he would tell, you know, ridiculously sort of interesting stories of how Princess Diana was killed by British intelligence. You know, and there were credible rumors about that even at the time, that her car crash was, you know, not completely innocent. But he claimed to have inside knowledge. He claimed to have inside knowledge on a lot of matters. And as a journalist and a novelist, that was like catnip to me.
Hmm. We're speaking with Walter Kern. He is going to be reading and talking about Blood Will Out and his other works on Wednesday night at Writers at the Loft at the Music Hall. Walter Kern, how did you figure it out? How was his secret exposed for you?
I never figured it out. His secret was exposed for me the same way it was for the entire country and everybody else who knew him. He kidnapped his daughter in Boston after a custody proceeding. There was an Amber Alert. He was caught days later. The Rockefeller family said, we don't know who this guy is. It came out that he was a German immigrant who'd come over here at 17 years old. Then, not long after that, it turned out he was a suspect in a murder all the way back to 1985, and a grisly murder, one in which the victim was cut up into pieces. And so can you think of a bigger disparity between terrible killer and supposed Rockefeller? I don't think there is one.
Mm. Well, you went to witness the trial for the murder of John Sohus, if I'm saying that properly. How did he behave to you there? I mean, you locked eyes at some points. Was he still pretending to be Clark Rockefeller or somebody else?
In the part of the trial that was in front of the jury, he did pretend to be Clark Rockefeller. He asked the judge, in fact, to call him Clark Rockefeller. His lawyers asked the judge, and the judge refused. But he dressed as he had as Clark, in a, you know, blue blazer, sockless loafers, wire-rimmed spectacles, and he acted very gentlemanly. Of course, on days when the jury wasn't there, he was brought in shackles and an orange prison jumpsuit. But, you know, when there was an audience judging him, he played the gentleman to a T.
Well, you were drawn in by him. I wonder, Walter Kern, do you think he picked you?
Well, no. I mean, it was an accident that we met. at Humane Society of Montana was the one who said, you know, can you talk to this guy? But I think as most con men and manipulators and sociopaths are able to do, he probably within 5 minutes of talking to me knew how he could manipulate me, what sort of cracks there were in my personality into which he could get leverage and so on.
Through this process of finding out from this manhunt who he really was and admitting and realizing that you've been duped, I'm interested about the process that you went through of thinking, oh, my God, it's all coming together.
Well, you see, this book is like the story of a magic trick. First, I show you what it was like to watch the magic trick, what it was like to be in his company and be fooled by him. And then I show you through the prism of attending his murder trial and finding out what his MO was and learning more and more about him, what I think really happened. Why, for example, did he show me a Rothko with blood on the back? Well, I think it was because he was obsessed with blood. He'd cut up a body. He'd probably lived with that body for a period of weeks in this little guest house while he was digging its grave, a way to cope with his, you know, nightmarish experience of bloody murder was to put blood on art and sort of upscale the whole experience. He played games of Clue dressed up in his finery as Professor Plum, and that was also an upscaling of, I think, the horrible murder experience. So the book is really double vision story.
Well, in painting the portrait of why you were duped, you actually go even further later in the book and suggest that you are somehow complicit in his masquerade. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, this may offend some, but I'm going to speak on a much larger scale. Clark, who I have evidence and reason to believe, is kind of maybe has some feelings for the Nazi past of Germany, maybe even some positive feelings. Came from a country that allowed one of the greatest crimes of all time to take place within its borders. And though everyone afterwards claimed that they hadn't seen it coming and didn't know what was going on, digging down tells you that even ignorance is in some ways a form of collaboration. Mm-hmm. I was very hard on myself looking back on the relationship because it wasn't just that I trusted him or was gullible or was blind. I also at certain levels wanted things from him, and I wanted those things badly enough not to pay attention to his inconsistencies and his tall tales. Very concretely, I used to think, oh, he'll give me a stock tip someday, sort of some Rockefeller or inside information that maybe I can use to help me and make a wise investment. Things like that. They say you can't cheat an honest man. And I was cheated. Therefore, I must not have been completely honest. I certainly wasn't honest with myself.
What about trusting people that you meet now? Are you, you know, sort of on tenderhooks and really wonder?
Well, I'll tell you honestly. I've gone on Twitter in the last week, and there are certain people who show up on Twitter who have profile photos that are, you know, pictures of movie stars, not themselves, and don't have any followers that I'm convinced are him. You know, in jail with a smuggled cell phone trying to make fun of me. It's the kind of thing he'd do. Ever since this experience, I've seen that there is much more masquerading and imposture out there in society than we realize. And once you know that, it does put a stutter in your step. It makes you a little paranoid, and I've healed from most of that. But, you know, in this age of Facebook and social media, when people are not always what they say they are or even who they say they are, we maybe are right to be a little paranoid. Mm-hmm. Not being completely trusting and vulnerable beings is probably a wise thing at this stage in history.
Walter Kern, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You can see Walter Kern tomorrow night at Writers in the Loft at the Music Hall Loft. He's going to be reading and speaking about Blood Will Out and his other work. You'll find details and ticket information on the event at wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is staying on the trail of the frauds with the curious tale of John Brinkley, a snake oil salesman from the 1930s who purchased a fake medical diploma and set out to cure men of impotence. That story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, the writer Walter Kern just told us about his friendship with Christian Gerhard Schrider, a con man, now a convicted murderer, who assumed several phony identities, including that of Clark Rockefeller from Cornish, New Hampshire. As a land of new beginnings, America has a long history of imposters and grifters. Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace podcast brings us this story about a man who went to dangerous lengths to cure men of erectile dysfunction back in the 1930s.
He wasn't exactly pretending to be a doctor, at least not by the time he was famous. I mean, there was a while in 1906, 1907, when Dr. John R. Brinkley was just flat out lying about the doctor part in order to better sell some snake oil. And so he bought a phony diploma through the mail. And so he charged $25 to inject people with what he called the new electric medicine from Germany, which was actually just colored water. If you're shelling out to get water with food coloring shot into your arm, at some point that's on you. Well, in 1915, John Romulus Brinkley spent $100 in a year at the Eclectic Medical University of Kansas City. And he could finally look a man in the eye and tell him he was indeed a doctor. Which I'd imagine would be reassuring to a man who came into his office in Milford, Kansas, and handed over $750 for the privilege of having Dr. Brinkley cut him open and insert pieces of goat testicles right there next to his own equipment. Beginning in 1917, Dr. John R. Brinkley did thousands of these operations, promising they'd cure impotence in men, and eventually promising that sticking goat testicles into people's bodies could fix up to 27 different common ailments. The operation, as you'd imagine, was incredibly painful. The recovery was long and miserable. And after it was all over, you had pieces of goat ball inside you. But people said they were cured. An editor at the LA Times set out to expose Dr. Brinkley as a quack. He got the operation, and he wound up proclaiming him a genius. People were sick or flaccid, and they saw Dr. Brinkley, and they were better. It didn't matter that there was absolutely no evidence that this was anything other than the placebo effect. It didn't matter that the American Medical Association was calling him a charlatan. People were sick, and then they weren't. And Dr. Brinkley was in their homes every day and night, making sure they understood just how sick they really were.
You're holding back, many of you, right now, listening to me. And you know you're sick. And you know that unless some relief comes to you, that you're going to be in the undertaker's parlor on the old cold slab being embalmed for a funeral. Why do you delay longer and take chances?
He started a small radio station next to his Kansas clinic. He was on the air all the time, hawking his ludicrous procedure. He'd go on air and answer mail from listeners. These were people who were desperate for sound medical information that they just could not get anywhere else there in the countryside. People who were relieved to find out that their problems could be fixed. They would save all winter. They'd hawk their belongings. They'd take out loans that they weren't quite sure they'd be able to repay. And they'd drive to Milford and get goat testicles put inside them. And some of them would die. By 1930, the state of Kansas had grown concerned about the 42 death certificates Brinkley had signed since he set up shop. They'd grown concerned that most of the dead were people that hadn't been sick before they showed up at the clinic. They were concerned that he often operated while drunk. And they were concerned that they had no way of knowing just how many people died after they went home from the hospital. So the state medical board took his license away. And soon the federal government took his radio station away. So John R. Brinkley went to a place where none of that mattered. In 1931, Brinkley set up a new station just over the border in Mexico that would soon make him one of the most powerful people in America. Safely out of the reach of the men in Washington who wanted to bring him down, Brinkley's bogus claims blasted out at a million watts. The station was so powerful that people living nearby heard it without even turning on the radio. The sound would shimmy up their bed springs, would vibrate in their skulls through their dental work. It was so powerful, people heard it in every state in the country, and then they drove down to the border to get fixed by the famous doctor, who wasn't really a doctor anymore. And all of this made John Romulus Brinkley a very wealthy man, with a mansion and 12 Cadillacs, and rare animals brought in from the Galapagos Islands just to wander around on his lawn. But you just can't make your fortune this way. and expect to ride off into the sunset. First, another doctor set up shop nearby, offering equally preposterous medical care, but at low, low prices. The feds got him on mail fraud. Ex-patients slapped him with lawsuits. The Mexican government sent in the army to shut him down. His audience turned the dial when he started giving Nazi sympathizers airtime during World War II. And he had to sell the mansion, right after he'd gotten tiles with swastikas installed in a swimming pool. You might say he got what he deserved in the end, when his health declined even faster than his fortunes. 3 heart attacks, a leg amputated after he developed circulation problems, a 4th heart attack that killed him in 1941. You might say he got what he deserved in the end. Except that that leg was cut off by an actual doctor.
Nate DiMeo there of the podcast The Memory Palace. You can find more on John Brinkley's story on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Oh, how many travelers get weary, bearing both their burdens and their scars. Don't you think they'd love to start all over and fly like eagles out among the stars?
The voice is instantly familiar, but even for the most devout Johnny Cash fan, the tune is not. It's the title track from Out Among the Stars, an album recorded in the 1980s that was unceremoniously shelved by Johnny Cash's record company at the time, Columbia. Fortunately for Cash lovers and music historians out there, it is being released by Legacy Recordings today. So why was the album lost, and how does it fit into the Cash and American music canon? We invited Robert Baird, music editor of Stereophile, to help answer some of those questions. Robert Baird, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
So before we dig into the origins of Out Among the Stars, what do you think of the album? Did you give it a grade?
The voice is wonderful. The tunes, maybe a little less so, but it's energetic. It's really vital Cash.
Okay. Sounds a little bit qualified.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's certainly for Cash lovers, it's going to be an essential record. Is it the record to start with? No. Is it wonderful that it's finally out? Yes. And was it a whole record as opposed to a collection of tracks? It was indeed.
So how does the
production... Which makes it very important in its own way.
Well, right. So it's not just, you know, assembled lost tunes, but something put together as an album. How does the production compare with other Cash albums?
The production is good. I mean, the production is interesting because Billy Sherrill, who produced the record, who was George Jones's producer for many years and is sort of renowned for slathering everything with oceans of violins, doesn't do that here. He really lets Johnny Cash's voice stand out. He really goes for a bare bones production style that's completely unlike him. It's certainly the early 1980s. It's certainly the quote unquote contrapolitan style that Billy Sherrill was renowned for, but again, pretty stark for him. And again, I think Johnny Cash's voice, he's fresh out of a rehab stint. His voice is very clear, and he seems very focused on this project.
The album has a couple of duets, one with June Carter Cash, a novelty
there
song
is.
Featuring Minnie Pearl, a duet with Waylon Jennings, and 2 versions of She Used to Love Me a Lot. This is the song called After All.
Our love didn't last long. What went wrong? Who's to say? If you'd never been by, how then could I begin to say? After all this time, and you're still a friend of mine, so I believe in someone after all.
That strikes me as a little bit beyond the range of a regular Johnny Cash song. How about you?
Well, it depends on what period you're thinking of. Johnny Cash, with the Sun sessions in the very beginning and then with the Rick Rubin sessions at the end of his life, both of those are very starkly produced. So there was he was never really one of those sort of overtly commercial country artist. He was never, his productions always tended to be less commercial and less overproduced than everyone else's. So it's, yes, as far as the beginning and the end of his life is concerned, it's much more produced than that. But in the grand scheme of country music, not really.
So you mentioned he was fresh out of rehab when this record was made. Voice maybe strong and emotive. What was going on in the life and career of Johnny Cash at that time in the 80s?
Well, he was coming to the end of his relationship with Columbia Records, where he had been since 1958. And, you know, this is often portrayed as a tragedy, and a lot of people still have hard feelings towards Columbia at this time. But Columbia Nashville, it had come to a point where I think they had run out of ideas. And I think sometimes between artists and record labels, there comes a time, and I think 28 years is an extraordinary long time for a label and an artist to be together, and they had had a lot of success. But I think things had stagnated, and it was certainly time, and regimes change at record labels, and maybe Johnny Cash didn't have any more people to speak for him, people who were his champions at the label. And again, this was a time when Kenny Rogers had Lionel Richie producing a record for him, where he started to work with David Foster. Country music was going through one of its periodic, very slick, very poppy periods. And Johnny Cash's voice sort of represented the past, I think, to a lot of people, certainly to a younger generation in Nashville. And so he was a little depressed. There's a quote from his autobiography, which I think summarizes this period really well. The turn of the decade was a good time for my music. The same wasn't true of my record sales, though, and my attitude suffered. Sometimes in the early 80s, I really cared about recording, but sometimes I didn't. It was hard to get excited about an album project when I knew the people at my label had come to regard me as a long shot, and when the chips were down, weren't willing to put money and muscle into pushing my records. They and all the other major record companies in Nashville were betting on the younger generation and starting to play by the rules of the, quote, youth appeal, unquote. If you were a little too old and your anatomy not quite, quote, hot, unquote, it didn't matter how good your songs or your records were or how many fans you'd had for how long, you weren't going to get played on the radio. So my record company was losing interest in me and I in them.
Robert Baird there, he's music editor of Stereophile, reading from Johnny Cash's autobiography about, I guess, being dissed or being dropped by Columbia Records in the 1980s. This is, of course, Eddie Rabbit was riding high in the country music charts and crossover
charts.
Absolutely,
Alabama.
Right.
Yeah.
So could any of the songs on this album have been hits in the 80s if Columbia had really been behind it?
I think so, for sure. I think that the duet with Waylon, for example, had a lot of potential that could have been. And it's sort of the serendipitous tune on this record. He just kind of, quote-unquote, walked in off the street and did this. And they were old friends, of course. They were old roommates, of course. And I think that tune had a lot of commercial potential. I think you get to see a little bit of the future in this record as well, because I drove her out of her mind, and she used to love me a lot. Both have a little bit of outlaw in there, which Rick Rubin then sort of really enhanced and turned into the last five or six records in Johnny's life.
Well, let's listen to I'm Moving On. This is a duet with Waylon Jennings of an old Hank Snow song.
That big loud whistle as it blew and blew said hello to the Southland. We're coming to you and we're moving on. Oh, hear my song. You had to laugh for me, so I'm setting you free, so we're moving on. Mr. Fireman, won't you please listen to me, cause I got a birdie mama in Tennessee. Keep moving me on, keep rolling on. So shovel the coal and let's just rattle and roll and keep moving on.
Duet with Waylon Jennings and, of course, Johnny Cash of I'm Moving On. It is one of the tracks from a new record, if you can believe that, called Out Among the Stars. It was recorded in 1980s by Johnny Cash and then shelved by his record companies. We're talking about that record today with Robert Baird. Well, why did this album come out now at a time when country music is in a similarly pop-oriented phase?
Yeah, good question. There seems to be there's a real movement, Miles Davis, Jimi Hendrix, there's a real movement towards posthumous records these days, particularly at Sony Legacy. And I think it's a wonderful trend. I mean, this should have come out years ago. It's John Carter Cash, who is Johnny and June Carter Cash's son, who was behind this. And it was recorded as a whole record. It took some tweaking. They brought in Marty Stewart to redo his guitar parts. Marty Stewart was on the original record, and Marty Stewart came back in and did those guitar parts. I think, freshened it up a little bit, and I think that It's a pretty important document. To have a whole record shelf, to have a bunch of scattered tracks is one thing, but to have a coherent record that was shelved and was just sitting all these years, it was sort of a natural to re-release it. And Johnny Cash has new respect. Rick Rubin and the records that he made with Johnny Cash towards the end of Cash's life really gave Johnny a whole new cachet with the rock and roll crowd. And it's, you know, it was high time.
Well, Johnny Cash is a legend in American music. And as you said, you know, the hipster scene kind of, or the Americana hipsters kind of picked him up. But why do you think he endures as a musician and a symbol of really authentic cool, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, in 2014?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the black clothes, which, of course, is always very, that's very 2014. There's a great honesty to Johnny Cash, both to his voice and to his approach and his life. He was, you know, he didn't give in to overly slick productions. He didn't record songs he didn't believe in. He was genuinely patriotic. He did genuinely love his wife. He did genuinely love country music. And that honesty resonates today just like it did then. It's just that, you know, again, times change and records sell for different reasons. And at that moment in history, it just wasn't going to happen.
All right. I was going to ask which song you'd like to go out with, but I'm going to advocate for Baby Ride Easy, a duet with June Carter. What do you think?
Great, great choice.
Robert Baird, editor of Stereophile. Now, if you'd like to hear a sampling of the new Johnny Cash record, we do have a link to some of the tunes. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And here, I guess, is the answer to Jackson, Baby Ride Easy, a duet between Johnny Cash and June Carter from, if you can believe it, the Johnny Cash record that comes out today.
I eat my baby ride easy, ride high on the saddle all day.
If your lovin' is good
and your cookin' ain't greasy, the chuck wagon and we'll ride away.
Achieving professional musician status is no small feat, but the chances of making it as a novelist in America may be even more remote. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to travel two of the prevailing paths for aspiring writers. That story when we return after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fiction writers hoping to live off their wits and words have a hard road to hoe in contemporary America. Short of being independently wealthy or moving in with your parents, most aspiring writers get pulled toward one of two centers of gravity for American fiction writers: getting a master's and eventually a teaching job in an academic writing program, or moving to New York to get a day job until you make enough of a name for yourself to land a book deal. In either case, you will likely spend large sums of money on tuition or on rent in pursuit of a dream achievable by few. 2 years ago, Chad Harbach, editor and founder of N Plus One magazine, addressed the two-headed system in an essay called MFA versus NYC. Now, that article struck a nerve with plenty of writers, and Chad has taken it a step further, compiling a collection of essays on what the two-headed system has meant for writers and writing. Chad Harbach is also author of the best-selling novel, The Art of Fielding, and we welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
Well, you write that some of the people who read that original essay, MFA versus NYC, found it depressing. What was the response?
Well, yeah, you know, the essay was printed in, it was in N Plus One, as you mentioned, and then it was posted online at Slate. And there was a lot of discussion afterwards, a lot of people writing to me and to N Plus One, you know, many of whom found my essay really depressing. I hadn't sort of conceived of it as such because, you know, if you look at it historically, it's always been incredibly difficult for a writer to make a living. That was true 150 years ago, it was true 50 years ago, and it's true today. And the kind of specifics of that change, but I think that, you know, it's always been a labor of love and a very difficult business. I didn't think that what I was saying was necessarily extra depressing, but some people found it so, and partly simply because it is depressing to look at these things from a kind of sociological or economic point of view instead of, you know, as we often like to and should do, from the point of view of pure artistic inspiration.
In this collection, writers from Maria Adelman to George Saunders to David Foster Wallace write about the two roads aspiring writers tend to walk. Now, how, Chad, would you describe those two roads in summary?
MFA is, you know, a lot of people now get MFAs. If there were 30 MFA programs in the early 80s, today there are 400 and some. You know, so it's a booming occupation and business. There are so many programs and increasingly jobs available within those programs. And so it's become a kind of world unto itself that a lot of young writers kind of orient themselves toward and have ambitions within that world to land a good teaching job. The other world, the world of New York, is kind of two things. It's both the young writer who moves to New York to make connections and kind of live in the kind of intellectual ferment that I think New York still possesses, and it's also the trade publishing industry.
I want to go further with this explosion of graduate-level writing programs over the past few decades. How do you think that has changed the way that writers feel about job security, and does that have any effect on how people write?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, job security is a kind of a crucial phrase, I think, because writers, even those who have made a big sum of money off a single book, say, have never had much job security. It's always a freelance job. You're always on to the next project, and not sure if you're ever going to finish that project, And so the growth of the university writing system, has been a boon for writers in terms of security. I mean, it's the place where a writer can have health insurance that's paid for by a company called a college, and a gym membership and a stable income, and that kind of stability, I think, can be exceptionally good for creativity. There's a kind of romance of the starving artist, but in fact, it's not easy to think about your art when you're
starving.
When you're really focused on how you're going to pay your rent. But of course, there is a kind of dark side to it, if you will, because these teaching jobs, although you can only get one by being a writer, the job, of course, is not writing. And so you suddenly, almost accidentally, have a pretty, consuming full-time job that is not actually that thing that you really want to be doing.
Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the essays in this book kind of portray that cushy academic job. The writing programs is undisciplined. The summer makeout camps run by people much more concerned about their own writing than teaching, and others that consider the immersion and room to spend so much time thinking about and talking about writing that you get in a graduate writing program as really beneficial. Any points that stuck out for you on either side?
On the student side, there's a very good essay in the book by Maria Adelman, who you mentioned earlier, who just finished her degree at the University of Virginia. And this is the University of Virginia is a funded program. And so, the MFA students are not paying tuition. And in fact, they even are getting a little stipend to help them pay their rent. She writes very well about all the ways in which even when she wasn't writing in this program, she had this kind of time and space away from economic pressure, to kind of develop as a person and as an artist. And this is something I too always say to, people like college students or people who have recently graduated from college who, ask me about MFAs. I always say, don't pay for it, because it's not a business degree. It's not a degree that is necessarily going to lead to anything, to a job, a career. The way to approach it is as kind of time and space to work on your writing, and that's best done if you are not paying tuition.
We're talking about the roads often traveled by fiction writers in America with Chad Harbach. He's editor and founder of N+1 magazine. He is also the editor of a compilation called MFA versus NYC, The Two Cultures of American Fiction. It has stirred up a lot of conversation among the literary set. And that's a question for you, Chad. The essays have been written by smart, often very funny people, writing about their own experience. But, you know, it can come off as writers talking to other writers. And ultimately, writing is about the product, right? Whether MFA writing programs are pounding the pavement in New York, does it matter to lovers of fiction? Does it matter when we're talking about the product of what's coming out, the books?
Well, it does matter at a broad level. You know, I always think that, you know, as a society, we're going to sort of get the writers who we deserve. You know, for instance, if we put as much kind of time and effort as a society into fiction writing as we did into, say, playing basketball, then our fiction writers would be just as great as our basketball players, who are really great. On a more specific level, you know, I think that, you know, there is a way in which the MFA programs as a whole have influenced American writing, but it's very it's very difficult to actually say in what ways that has happened, because there are so many kind of influence of the program is so diffuse, and the programs have become so widespread over the past few decades that even a writer who his or herself has not been to an MFA program has been influenced by a lot of writers who have.
Well, one of the writers in your collection, one of the essay writers in your collection, Elif Batuman, worries that we're replacing great literature with something lesser, which she calls excellent fiction. Given that we've been hearing predictions of the death of publishing as we know it in this atomized media age, we've been told it's inevitable for the last couple of years. Do you think that more people are going to be pushing for or flocking toward the patronage, the departmental expense accounts, the health insurance of the graduate writing program?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's already happened. The publishing industry kind of works on sort of an all or nothing model. You know, which makes sense according to the dynamics of book sales, because most books either sell a lot or a little, but it makes a lot less sense for the life of the writer. You know, and so, I mean, we've seen that, you know, the programs have expanded and, you know, and writers need and want that security. You know, the publishing industry's demise is, you know, constantly being discussed. But still, I have to point out that it hasn't happened yet. And in fact, the past 4 or 5 years have been quite good ones. And the, you know, the editors and agents and publishers are actually feeling fairly optimistic right now.
Mm. I didn't come away thinking that MFA versus NYC is a, you know, Bambi versus Godzilla kind of fight. There's no clear winner here. How about for you, say a bright young writer or an N+1 intern asks you, should I get an MFA at University of Virginia? Well, let's throw that one out because that one they don't pay for. Should I get an MFA at Syracuse or Charlottesville or whatever, or stay in New York and freelance in hope of getting a book deal? What do you say?
You know, I think it's I think it can be very valuable. I mean, it depends if, you know, some nowadays there are so many students who do so much undergraduate creative writing, you know, that perhaps they've already taken their share of workshops by the time they've graduated from college. Maybe those types of students should get out of workshops and just hunker down and write. But, you know, if you're like me and I was 25 when I went to do my MFA and I had never had any instruction in creative writing, you know, and I think the instruction was valuable, you know, and I think that, as I keep saying, like, the time away from a full-time job was valuable. Yes, I would recommend it. You know, and there's this kind of rhetoric that surrounds it that, you know, that says, well, you know, instead of getting an MFA, you should live in the real world. Mm. And I wonder what those people think about the life of an MFA student, because, I mean, my experience was that I very much was still living in the real world. You know, I just went to class for 6 hours a week.
Chad Harbach, editor and founder of N+1 magazine. He's also author of the best-selling novel, The Art of Fielding. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Chad has edited a new collection of wonderfully thoughtful essays called MFA versus NYC. It's kicked up quite a storm in the literary world and otherwise, and you can find links to some of the articles about it and more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you
you for spending some of your listening time with us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any part of the show, fear not. Our entire show is available as a daily podcast. You can simply search for NHPR Word of Mouth on iTunes and never miss out on the conversation. And please, tell a friend. After all, the best ideas travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.